And I'm moving on to our first pericope, which is John 14, 8 through 17. It is the Revised Common Lectionary passage for Pentecost on June the 5th. And it reads, Philip said to him, Lord, show us the Father, and we will be satisfied. And Jesus said to him, Have I been with you all this time, Philip, and you still do not know me? Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Do you not believe that I am in the Father, and the Father is in me? The words that I say to you, I do not speak on my own, but the Father who dwells in me does his works. Believe me that I am in the Father, and the Father is in me. But if you do not believe, then believe me because of the works themselves. Very truly, I tell you, the one who believes in me will also do the works that I do, and in fact, will do greater works than these, because I am going to the Father. I will do whatever you ask in my name, so that the Father may be glorified in the Son. If in my name you ask me for anything, I will do it. If you love me, you will keep my commandments, and I will ask the Father, and he will give you another advocate to be with you forever. This is the Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive, because it neither sees him nor knows him. You know him, because he abides with you, and he will be in you. Verse 11, Jenny, I am in the Father, and the Father is in me. I know this is a setup question, but what are the implications of this Father-Son relationship?
I think setup question is putting it quite mildly and gently, because we could spend the whole podcast on it. And in a lot of ways, I think we are spending the whole podcast on it. Mm-hmm. To me, the Father-Son relationship is the substance of the gospel, especially when we see that this relationship exists in the Spirit and has been extended to us. So this is a Trinitarian statement. And it also emphasizes that the Father's not different from the Son. Distinct, yes, of course, but not different. They're one. They're not. There's no separation here. There's no dualism, if you like. There is union. And so it's another indication that if we want to carve off Jesus from the Father in how we conceptualize the gospel, it just won't work. It is very much an indication that you cannot view Jesus as the Lone Ranger. That may well have been a phrase of Baxter's somewhere too. Someone has said it, I know, not me. But Jesus is not a sole agent, that he and the Father are together in that respect. But my instant thought really, when you first flagged that question with me, is not surprisingly of Professor J.B. Torrance, who would always say to his students, the heart of the New Testament is the relationship between the Father and the Son in the Spirit. And it went alongside his exhortation towards covenantal orientations in our beliefs about the Trinity. And I wonder whether the fact of the Father-Son and relationship is likewise the secret of peace and joy in believing, especially when we realize who Jesus actually is, who Jesus is and what he does and what he's made of humanity in the incarnation and his atonement. And the fact that the name of Jesus is such a loaded statement in that sense, because Jesus is sharing his sonship with us and mediates his relationship with the Father to us, and responds to the Father as a faithful human son. So there's a massive amount of in relation to the implications of the Father-Son relationship, because it's not just the Father-Son relationship. It's the Father-Son relationship being lived out in the Spirit and being extended to humanity through the Spirit, who was poured out upon Jesus. And through the Spirit, Jesus lived out his sonship as the true human being, the new Adam. And even in the later part of that passage, in verse 17, where Jesus says he'll send the Spirit as the advocate, he also notes that his disciples already know the Spirit because he already lives with them. And later, he will also be in them. And so the Father-Son relationship, from my point of view anyway, the Father-Son relationship speaks more to me about who I am than any contract I could try to set up and with Jesus does. and it speaks more to who I am than any spiritual brownie points I could run around trying to earn, just like the older brother did in the parable of the prodigal son. Look how that worked out for him. How we live as Christians, you know, our discipleship is important, sure, but it's because of what that means for our well-being. Ken Blue once said, I think it was Ken Blue, sin makes about as much sense as putting your lips in a blender. But I love that.
That makes no sense.
But this relationship of the Father and the Son in the Spirit is the death knell of religiosity, of religious performance as the site of acceptability or worth or identity with God. It means that God is far bigger and more loving and more gracious and more accepting of me than I might previously have imagined, and particularly much more loving and gracious and accepting of me and far more intensely relational and personal and glorious than my pride will be able to get its head around. Because I would like to be in my own pride. We were talking about this before. I would like to be a bigger player in the relationship. Thanks very much. What about me and all these wonderful things that I do for God? You know, but the other impact about this for me, which is sort of the flip side of that, is that our brokenness is nowhere near as impactful as we might have thought. You know, because I'm in the Father-Son relationship by the Spirit, and because all of that is a gift of grace, because the message of the New Testament is one of that Father-Son relationship being extended to humanity, that changes everything about how I view God, view myself, view my life, view all aspects of my day-to-day living, and view other people. I'm free to live out of that truth. God is a human being now. God is one of us. Jesus is still a human being. Yeah. You know, God is one of us. And so what does that relationship imply? You know, everything, right?
Yes.
I don't know whether you have this in the US or wherever else our listeners are, but, you know, in Australia at least, you know how in Sunday school the running joke is that the answer to every question that the Sunday school teacher poses is meant to be – Jesus, no matter what. You know, we've got one where, you know, the answer, they're describing a koala. It's grey, it's fluffy, it's got a white tail, and everyone's sitting there not putting their hand up. And then eventually one little kid puts their hand up and says, I know the answer's meant to be Jesus, but it sounds like a koala. You know, well, in Sunday school, the answer's meant to be Jesus. Excellent. But I know he is. But by implication, what we mean when we say Jesus is to see him in the fullness of who he is, especially in the tradition of the early church that the Torrences were drawing from. So we don't just mean Jesus, you know, the individual over here who is gracious enough to love us while we're still sinners. We mean Jesus, the incarnate beloved Son of the Father, who has included us within that relationship through the incarnation and his life, death, resurrection, and ascension. The gospel isn't about me. That's what the Father, Son, and Spirit relationship means. The gospel is not about me and what Jesus has done for me. It's about Jesus and his Father and what the Father and Son by the Spirit have done with and for and in the whole human race to bring that relationship of love to humanity and to give us our own place in that by sharing in Jesus' sonship. It's incredible, really, and it's unbelievably good news. And the Spirit enables us to believe in the love that God has for us, enables us to trust, and enables the obedience of faith. St. Paul said that. I can't remember where. Sorry. This is where the fact that I'm not a formally trained theologian has its advantages. I don't have to memorize all the verses. This is why faith itself is a gift of the Spirit. So my sin and my brokenness, you know, they're there and they're dealt with, but that's done in the context of restoring me to my full humanity so that I am able to live in the love and freedom that's been brought to me, rather than my biggest problem being that I'm sinful and God doesn't love me yet. You know, the Father-Son relationship is the most beautiful truth in the universe.
And that oneness, communion of Father and Son, gets revealed once again in Jesus saying that he doesn't speak of his own accord, but according to the abiding Father. Why is this an important statement? And what, if anything, can Christ followers learn about their own speech from this?
Well, firstly, I mean, so many things. And being an academic, I'd just say IBID, right? Like refer back to everything we've previously said. Because as you say, it is yet again a Trinitarian statement and a statement about oneness and the implications of that. In terms of what we can learn about our own speech, it actually speaks to us a bit about our own place, what it means to live as Christians, what it means to participate. Kevin Navarro has written a beautiful book looking at TF and JB's theology and picking up, it's called Trinitarian Doxology, and it looks at unpacking what it means that, you know, worship is part of our participation in the life of Father, Son, and Spirit. And there's a lot in our own speech and our own approach and our own engaging with others, which of course is what we do in relation to our own speech, that needs to be impacted by living out in this life of the Spirit. And it affects our worship, it affects how we deal with each other, it affects how we treat each other. But importantly, because Jesus, he's not speaking of his own accord, but according to the Father, but he's still himself in that relationship. So it doesn't mean that we stop being ourselves and we just start running around trying to mimic Jesus, right? Jesus was participating with and living out of his relationship with his Father, and we're to do that as well. So we don't lose ourselves in this. We find ourselves in this, right? Mm-hmm. But there's no call, and this is an issue that I'm really hot on because there is an overlap here, I guess, with my other work. There is no call for hatred of one another or for undignifying speech and attitudes towards one another.
Preach.
Because the first thing we know about anyone is who they are to Jesus Christ. And, of course, because of the Trinity and the oneness of the Father, Son, and Spirit, that is also who they are to the Father. It is not just Jesus who loves people. You know, it is Father, Son, and Spirit. So the first thing we know about anyone is who they are to Jesus Christ. They are someone for whom he died and with whom he has shared his relationship with the Father. Now, some people believe that, some people don't, but that is the only difference. The difference, if you will, is on our side of the table, not God's side. God does not love non-Christians less than me.
Yes.
He is no less their father. They just don't know who he is yet. But that doesn't stop him being who he is, because this is covenantal, right? Not contractual. We're not dualistic. And it doesn't stop him loving them. So our speech, our actions, and our attitudes to God, which is where worship as participation comes in, but also our attitudes to ourselves and to other people and the way in which our speech, our self-talk and our communication with other people are affected, all of those things need to be oriented around our identity and participation in Jesus' relationship with the Father. That's what we're living in and living out of and speaking out of as well. So one of the things that I found myself writing, I'm going to digress a bit into my thesis. One of the things I found myself writing in relation to family violence and how we approach what a covenantal understanding of marriage would mean in relation to what a marriage relationship should look like and the profound absence of anything that remotely looks like violence that covenant implies. There's no space for it. I found myself writing that a Christian man's wife should be the last person that he thinks of treating badly because it is a relationship of unconditional love. And in the same way, Christians should be the last people to treat anyone poorly or speak of anyone poorly, because every single person we encounter is as loved by Jesus as we are. You know, and later in John, Jesus talks about the Father loving us with the same love that he has loved the Son with. And we gloss over that. We miss it so much. But there's something that is profound in relation to this. And our speech and the way we treat ourselves and the way we treat others has to reflect that. Mm-hmm. So there's Christian ethics wrapped up in this, living life in accordance with the gospel. You know, if we are Christians, we are lovers of people. I'm doing auditing a Christian spirituality course at a Bible college here at the moment. And our lecturer, David McGregor, said literally 2 days ago, if we are Christians, we are lovers of people because God loves them. We recognize no one from a worldly point of view, but we see them and we see everything through Christ now. And I think one profoundly important aspect of how we are to speak then not only involves how we speak about others and how we speak to them, but also how we speak about ourselves and how we treat ourselves.
Mm. Yeah, that's so powerful what you just said on two fronts, the way that we relate with others, but also the way that we relate with ourselves, the self-talk. Very, very insightful. Thank you.
But I suppose the only thing I would add to that is that a contractual model of the gospel encourages us to focus on our brokenness and our sin and how unacceptable we are, and thank God for Jesus that Jesus has made us acceptable now. And while dealing with sin is of course profoundly important in the gospel, mm-hmm. this emphasis and this overemphasis on how horrible we are, rather than our core identity being as loved children, which is why God doesn't want to leave us in our brokenness, you know, is a really important point. We find it really hard to believe in how much we're actually loved by Father, Son, and Spirit.
Yeah.
And so often, and we treat ourselves so badly because we start from a place of, I'm a dreadful sinner, rather than the primary thing about me is I am a loved child of God, and God will deal with all of the brokenness and mess that stops me from living in his love and seeing him for who he is, and will make me, you know, what I need to be. And that those things are sorted out along the way rather than being the primary thing that we need to focus on.
Yeah, we talk to ourselves contractually, and we think of others that way. And I, you know, as we're recording this, we have Russia invading the Ukraine. And I noticed on social media, there was a lot of posts about Ukraine and what they provide to the world, you know, their natural resources, yada, yada, yada. And I couldn't help but think, no, they're people. I mean, mm-hmm. yes, there are things that they provide, but it's a way of thinking of things contractually as opposed to those are beloved children. They are loved by the Son and the Father and the Spirit. That you know, let's stop thinking contractually about what they can provide the world and just recognize these beautiful image bearers of the living God.
Well, it's the social contract. I might have seen the same post. I'm not sure. But it's, why is this important? And then it lists off all these ways in which we understand Ukraine's position in the wider world and the various things that, you know, they export and whatever else. And that is the social contract.
Yes.
Right there, you know, what is our utility? Why are we gathering ourselves together? How are we going to sort of fit into this great piece and puzzle? I don't care about any of it. That's not why. This war is so appalling. It's appalling because everyone involved in it is profoundly loved.
That's right.
By Jesus. The preservation of life and the dignity of human beings is far more fundamental than what we can do for each other or what we bring to the table. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a completely different way of looking at humanity.
Yeah. Yeah, and what we often forget is that war does harm on both sides, to victim and victimizer, because of whose image we're made into. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, Pentecost will be celebrated this Sunday, and many sermons will focus, Jenny, on the promise and deliverance of the Holy Spirit. What does this passage indicate about who the Spirit is and what God the Spirit is doing these days?
In a move that will surprise no one, I'm going to start by saying that this is a Trinitarian statement. which pretty much all of these passages are, right? I think I've started all of my answers that way. But there are particular things that are highlighted in this quite beautifully. Firstly, the Spirit in this passage is given to us by the Father. Secondly, the Spirit is the Spirit of truth. And also we know the Spirit due to the fact that we have the Spirit in us. So this is deeply relational and deeply Trinitarian. And the connection here is between our need for truth and the advocacy of the Spirit who is with us forever, which makes me think to myself, okay, well, what is the Spirit advocating and what is this truth? And to me, the Spirit shares the Father-Son relationship with us. We've talked about that. And it gets back to the point that Jesus makes at the start of the passage. He's in the Father and the Father's in him. And he finishes that later in this address to his disciples. I am in my Father and you in me and I in you. And all of that, of course, occurs in the Spirit. So what we see here is a forever relationship. I love how it says, and he'll be with you forever. It's a forever relationship which is brought to us in the Spirit, and we're to live in and out of that truth right throughout our lives. The world can't see this truth yet, but it's true nonetheless, and we're bound up irrevocably in it because of the Spirit. So we can't actually lose the love of God because of the Spirit. And the Spirit will keep bringing that home to us and calling us back to that truth when we struggle to see it in the midst of our own brokenness and trauma and everything else that makes it hard for us to believe. Because we have the mind of Christ. We have his righteousness, and he's brought us into that life and love of God that exists between the persons of the Trinity. And it's by the Spirit that we see that. By the Spirit, we cry, Abba, Father, right? So when we know who God is, we know who we are, and it's through the Spirit that we're enabled to receive and see and participate in what God's doing. As I said earlier, my Bible college professor, Dave McGregor, was saying this the other day in class. Christian spirituality is not about our journey of discovery. If it's Christian spirituality, it's about the Spirit, because our response to God is enabled by the Spirit. So through the Spirit, we participate and share in all that Jesus is and has. So the Spirit is critical. And in terms of, is the Spirit doing anything today? The Spirit is doing everything today, right? Because this is an ongoing forever relationship, you know, and out of that, we participate in our church communities, in our work, in our families, in whatever shape life takes for us. Our text in the topic that I'm doing is Marjorie Thompson's book, Soul Feast, An Invitation to the Christian Spiritual Life. And she says on page 14, the spiritual life is not one slice of existence, but leaven for the whole loaf. You know, the Spirit is continually active in the world today. That's what I see coming through really clearly in this passage.